Okay. All right. Well, we're at Sydney Motorsport Park, formerly Eastern Creek Raceway, for the Barry Sheen Festival of Speed. And it's a great pleasure and a great honour to talk to 8 times world champion Phil Reed, who I'm guessing would have some fairly amazing memories of the man after whom this meeting is named.
Well, yeah, Barry, I first met him when I rode Bultaco for his father, Mel Franco, in the Isle of Man in 1961. In actual fact, that was my first TT race on the Sheen Bultaco. And I was very, very pleased that it stopped after half a lap, because it was so slow.
Yes.
And Barry was, I don't know, was 10 years old then, and kept coming and interfering and messing in my toolbox, and I used to give him half a crown, like 2 and 6, to go and get an ice cream, because I was really more interested in Maggie at the time, who was just 16. No, it was great. And then obviously Barry got competitive, and I set up races. I slowed down for him when I was on a faster bike and let him pass, and we changed places and get the crowd excited and just pip him in the end, and the headlines of Barry Sheen, you know, up and coming Barry Sheen, you know, challenges Phil Reed. Well, then he got the factory Suzuki ride, which actually after a season with Barry, they asked me to come and test in Japan, which I did. And they asked me to contract with them, but I felt that the Suzuki at the time weren't ready for me. They were having a lot of gearbox problems, and I don't need gearbox problems. And anyway, I decided then to accept a better offer from MV Agusta.
Famously, and I need you to correct me on this, because I've quoted you for years on this one. Famously, you are quoted as having said that you don't like two strokes because you spend the whole of the off season catching flies with your left hand, but when the time comes, it's too slow. Did you actually say that?
Not quite, no, but you've got to have reactions like a shit house rat, actually, to catch the clutch before it's they seize. And I remember when we were testing at the Fuji circuit, I was waiting for it to seize, because it was that sort of atmosphere. It was coldish and it was damp, and that's the side, like the weather that causes two strokes to seize. And I'm flat out around the banking doing 150 mile an hour, boop, and it seized. And I pulled the clutch in and I felt myself up in the air. And luckily I didn't hear anything. But I tell you, you've got to be quick. But you know, now they don't race with two strokes in the Grand Prix, and they don't seize. But yeah, it was. You had to be pretty quick. You had about 0.3 of a second to react. Any little sort of miss and whoop, you pull the clutch in. But, you know, they were interesting days, you know, because Yamaha then were on a very steep learning curve. And obviously I had quite a bit of experience on the short circuits and with the Jaleras and with my Manxes and G50s in 2 years of Grand Prix. And I helped to bring them up to speed, and that was really, really challenging.
The air cooled bikes, of course, gave you virtually no warning. At least when they went to water cooling on the two strokes, they gave you a little bit of warning, but
not really. Not that you noticed, you know, a tenth of a second.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Phil, you've won 8 world championships over a period of goodness knows how many years. You started racing when you were very young and did your last race in 1982?
Yeah, in the TT, yeah.
In the TT?
Yeah.
How many TTs did you end up winning?
Well, I won 8 TTs, yeah.
Yeah.
And retired, leading 3 others. So, and with the world championships in for 2 years running, I had equal points to Mike Howard.
That's right, yes, and he won because...
He had one more second place than me, yeah.
That's right, yes. Life can be incredibly unfair, can't it?
Because then it was, they counted the points, not gross points like they do now. It's like half the results plus one, you know, so you could have a retirement or crash and not count it. Mm. But I actually had more points than Mike, but that they were the rules at the time.
Sure.
And Mike was one of the greatest riders in the world, and Hondas were very, very competitive against...
What's your memories of Mike?
Oh, well, he was great fun to be around. Obviously, we resented him arriving in the back of his father's Continental Bentley, and a big transporter arrive, and he'd have two of each bike and two mechanics, but you could easily have disliked him, but he was one of the boys, you know, chasing the birds, and he organised parties, and a big drinker, and I know at the race of the year he organised Chris Barber to come along there. A couple of times, you know, and we had a party in the clubhouse. That was brilliant.
Yeah.
It's the only rider I know that has done that. Even though Mike wasn't earning fortunes then, compared with the money they're earning now.
No.
Yeah.
No, he was. I was fortunate enough to meet Mike a couple of times when he came out here and raced in Australia, and he was an astonishing character. He was a hilarious guy to be around.
Yeah.
One of my enduring memories of Mike was his ability to quote vast slabs of Goon Show scripts, complete with all the correct accents and so forth, which was quite amazing. Yeah, he could do an Eccles better than Peter Sellers could do Eccles. It was amazing.
Well, obviously. I think Mike had a lot of time in his hands. He used to listen to these records, or this was before they had CDs and
yes.
DVDs. Yeah,
yeah.
But no, he was one of the boys and one of the most skillful riders that I've competed against.
Who had astonishing longevity in the sport as well.
Well, he did, and well, we do miss him now. I mean, all we've got is Agostini, and and a few of the later ones, Christian Sarron, who is and then the Americans come over.
Robertson Baker and
yeah.
Spencer.
And they like to show their abilities.
Yes.
I know, talking to Kenny Roberts last year at Mallory Park, and we all changed together in the clubhouse, and he said, I used to get changed, go and finish a Grand Prix, and come back exhausted. Now all I have to do is put my leathers on and I'm exhausted.
Yep, well, time wounds all heals, they say.
Well, I'm amazed that I'm still fairly competitive at 75 years old.
Phil, you've become sort of dragged back to the sport a little bit with your involvement with Classic Spa and some of these other events
well,
and so forth, and and meeting again with people like Spencer and Baker and all those guys
it's
and
good.
Mixing with them. It must be a great thrill.
Yeah, it's good.
For
it's, yeah, there's no pressure on you because of these big parade events and they get well attended. You know, 50,000-60,000.
Yes.
There's no pressure to win. You know, so. We usually, you know, put on a good demonstration, the bikes together, and the crowd love it.
Mm, sure. Phil, at the time there was a time there where controversy seemed to follow you pretty much everywhere you went. You had a famous rivalry with the late Bill Ivy, which I'm guessing the media probably made much more of than what it really was at the time. But it must have been a difficult time for you at that stage.
Well, in actual fact, we made it because because I didn't follow team orders, which were unofficial team orders, because it was against the FIM code.
Correct.
To ride to team orders, right?
Mm-hmm. And still is.
And still is. And when I didn't slow down for Bill in Czechoslovakia, in Brno, and... he came in and said, you bastard Phil, you should have ridden to team orders, and the press were round and they knew there was some trouble. So everyone knew that I contravened the unofficial team orders and hadn't let Bill win. Because he'd been saying, I heard in the paddock, that he's going to beat Phil Reed, knowing that we had team orders to let him win the 250. So then if I'd have said to Bill, well, okay Bill, I'm sorry, I'll let you win. It would have been no prestige for Bill.
No.
Everyone would have known that
yes.
I was letting him win.
Yep.
So we raced.
Yes.
And I won.
Yes.
And that's how it should be, I think. But what made it worse, of course, was next year Bill was killed in Saxon Ring.
Yes. Dreadfully dangerous track.
Oh, I know. But anyway, I mean, we had about five or six events that were on roads. You know, there was the Isle of Man, the Ulster Grand Prix, obviously East Germany, Saxon Ring through the town.
Yes. Was that on the original Brno circuit, the big, the long Brno circuit that you raced?
Well,
or the short
through the village, down into the open and back up.
Yes.
Climb into the hill, over the cobblestones, down the cutting, over the railway. Yeah.
And in Martra, over the railway crossing?
That's right, yeah, that's another one. So, we rode on, you know, road circuits, so without any runoff. So if you did crash, I mean, you were probably dead.
On tiny little narrow tyres and hard compound.
Those stupid triangular things.
Trigonic tyres, yes.
Stupid, yeah. Because there was a contract, I mean, to supply, Dunlop to supply Yamaha, say, with free tyres, I think was a mistake, short-sighted, because the Yokohama tyres I tested in Japan were superior.
To the Dunlops?
Yeah, at the time, and I think if we'd have worked with Yokohama or Bridgestone, with Yamaha, them to develop tyres for the Yamaha team, we'd have won more races and stopped Honda winning.
And on the way up here, you were saying that you raced in a time when racing was safe and sex was dangerous.
Dangerous, yeah.
The other way around.
The other way around. Racing was dangerous and sex was safe,
that's
yeah.
Right. Looking back on it now, that must be a particularly nice memory of all the friends who you lost at those times, because the carnage back then was terrible.
Yeah, we lose about two, three a year. That was terrible. That's a bit like Formula One racing as well. I mean,
yes.
But I think with Jackie Stewart, got all the drivers and teams together and forced the FMI to put Armcos round, you know. Mm. So, I mean, Jim Clark was... Jim Clark was killed at Hockenheim because he spun off into the trees, you see.
That's right, yes.
If he'd have been a barrier there, he'd have bounced off and spun and been alive today.
Correct, yes. Yes, it's a tragedy. A couple of other things that I wanted to ask you about, Phil, and I'm able to ask you this because I'm operating at a huge distance, but it seems to me that every promising young British rider comes up must carry the weight of the British press's expectation for him to be the next Barry Sheen. It's really been bad for the career of some of your very promising British riders who probably would have done much better than they did if it weren't for that expectation.
Now, I don't think that's true, actually.
Okay, well, that's fine. No. That's what I'm saying. That's what it looks like.
No, you know, I don't think that's
true. You know, the young British bloke comes up, they say, oh, he's the next Barry Sheen.
Yeah. That's right. If I'd have continued in 76, you know, with a bit more sponsorship, because I pulled out halfway through the season.
Yes.
Because my sponsor then disappeared. When I had a coach, I had Jeff Howie from up in Brisbane, who's coming here tomorrow as a mechanic, and a couple of other workers. They had a big coach carrying the bikes around. And I was battling with Barry to Mugello, the Italian Grand Prix. We were like this throughout the race. And I passed him into the last corner. I had a private bike and he had a factory Suzuki. Just pipped me across the line. And I think on other circuits where the straights weren't as long, I could have beaten him. But then he won that year and the next year, and then... So there was no real competition, only in the Suzuki team, with Dieter Brown and Jack Finley, and also Paul Smart rode the factory Suzukis. So, and then Kenny Roberts came over, you see. It was a really hot rider, and Barry struggled to beat him.
3 years in a row.
So Barry was a good rider. He was good for the sport. He gave it a lot of publicity. He was a bit, should we say, extrovert. In his
lifestyle.
In his lifestyle with ladies, yeah.
Yes, yes. And still, he eventually married and settled down with one, and they had a very long and happy marriage, didn't they?
Until she divorced him.
Yeah. And his son's racing now.
Freddie's fantastic. Beautiful boy.
Is he good?
Terrific. Yeah.
Terrific.
Very easygoing and happy and also a fantastic rider. We were at Verano last year, riding for the same team on the Suzukis, and one was the older one, the Mark one, and Freddie was riding a later one, which was quicker, but he said to me, "I've never been here before, Phil, can I follow you around?" So I showed him around the circuit, and then he passed me and disappeared. Wow, I thought, terrific. Knee on the ground and...
Absolutely.
No, he'll be terrific. But I just hope he doesn't try and assimilate his father.
Sure.
Because it's difficult.
Oh, well, there was only one Barry, wasn't there? Yeah. Phil, I'm struggling here a little because the great rivalry of your era was you and Agostini and Halewood and Sheen. It's difficult not to talk about Barry, particularly as we're at the Barry Sheen meeting.
Yeah, sure.
Famously, you and he clashed on the subject of the TT, didn't you?
Well, I think he agreed, in actual fact, because the first TT he did, he only lasted till the first corner, at Quarter Bridge, and crashed.
Right.
I think he agreed that it shouldn't be in the World Championship Series. Certainly Agostini did as well. But I got the flak for that.
Hmm.
Because as 5 times world champion, the last TT I did, the ACU, who were the organisers then, paid me £50 expensive, £50.
Wow.
And I won a race there, and the prize money was 100. So I was out of pocket for 2 weeks over there. And then they lost their world championship status.
Mm-hmm.
3 years later.
Mm-hmm.
They paid me £12,000.
Wow.
Yeah. £4,000 a start.
Then?
3 years later, that's how much money they had over there in the kitty and how much they were making out of the riders, it being a world championship event, because the FIM, obviously the organisers all stuck together, and we've got to keep the money down so we can make some money. I mean, the Dutch were probably the worst. They'd pay you about 100 guilders if you were lucky, and they'd say, well, if you don't like it, don't start. Because obviously, most of the privateers had to have this money.
They relied on that for their living.
Yeah, it was hand to mouth, you see.
Yes, living out of the back of a Ford Thames van.
Exactly, and the factory riders had to ride because they were contracted to ride.
The factory, yeah.
So
the organisers had them over a barrel, and that was where Kenny Roberts tried to start the World Series thing, didn't he? Because he saw how inequitable that was.
Well, I did too earlier on, but we couldn't get all the riders and teams to stick together, which is a shame.
Yeah.
And this is another reason that I objected to the TT, you see. From £50 to £12,000 in 3 years, and the prize money. I went away from the TT having won 2 races in 77 with £18,000, you know, in my pocket. And
that's outrageous, isn't it?
Outrageous. But now, of course, the top riders have paid really good money.
Yes. Yeah.
To go over them, and so they should be.
And so they should be. I agree, yes, and so they should be.
Because it attracts, you know, the island is full to capacity. There aren't enough boarding houses now, and they open campsites, and the majority of the spectators camp in tents, and they provide, the owners provide showers and toilets and restaurants and fun. It can be a good party, you know. So, anyway, yeah. So now it's changed, and I think it's for the better.
What's your take on what's happening in Grand Prix racing now compared to, or not even necessarily compared to your day? Just what do you think of Grand Prix racing the way that it is now?
I'm totally confused now, because the Ducati have gone into a different class. What they call it now, standard.
Yeah, open class.
Open class.
Yes.
Yeah, where they can have an extra 4 litres of fuel.
More softer tyres, more of them, more engines.
Yeah, exactly, and do development.
But then if they win a race, they get penalised.
But now that's a rule just being brought in.
That's right, yeah, ad hoc, with no consultation with anyone.
Well, only the Honda chief and the two Honda chiefs, the Japanese and the Italian engineer, used to be with Ducati.
Livio Super.
Livio, yeah. The other group, Erta.
Yep.
Yeah. It's crazy, no? Mm. So if the caddy do well and have get on the podiums, they'll be restricted and they'll be back to finishing fifth and sixth again. Mm. You know, it's like that Honda feel that they've got the monopoly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they can control it. But, I mean, they're a multi-billion pound company. And obviously it's important for them to win the championships.
Yeah.
And to fight for it. And I think because they supply all the engines for the GP2, all Hendler engines the same, you know, and put a lot of investment into Dorna, that they have to be listened to. I think it's a shame.
They feel
like
they have the right to be listened to. Yeah.
No, it's...
Who impresses you in the world of racing these days, Phil?
Well, I think all the top riders are fantastic. I mean, but especially Marc Marquez, in winning the championship last year, he crashed 15 times. 15. But was virtually unhurt, where compared with Jorge, Lorenzo crashed 3 times and broke his collarbone twice, which was a bit unfair. But if Marquez hadn't pushed Lorenzo out at Jerez,
yes.
and Jorge George, as I call him, would have won, he'd have won the world championship. But
things hinge on tiny things, don't they?
Exactly, and I think then Marquez should have been not disqualified, but penalised 5 seconds, or he do, for that move. He moved Lorenzo out of the way.
But the defenders will say, well, Rossi did exactly the same thing to Gibbenauer a few years ago and he got away with it as well. In the same corner. And he put Gibbenauer in the gravel. It's exactly the same situation. So, you know, it's hard. I know what you're saying. And, of course, the comparison between Rossi and Stoner at the corkscrew corner at...
but it was different because I seen both of them. Rossi came up the inside and stayed there, and then Gibbenauer picked it up.
Yes.
If he'd have kept it down and kept it on, they'd have been okay.
But
Marquez pushed really... Lorenzo
very
out.
Late on brakes.
Pushed him out.
Yes. Look, I know what you're saying, and I'm guessing that these issues are going to be argued for a long while. The same as the issue of the two passes in the corkscrew with Stoner and Rossi in 2008, and then Rossi and Marquez in 2013.
Yeah.
And you know, you can examine those from all different angles and say, well, look, you know, there's similarities, there's differences, but I think what it shows, or what it showed to me, is how utterly ruthless you have to be now.
And how brave and take chances to take advantage.
Yes.
You know, it's a bit like Formula One racing. I mean, you have to be pretty desperate to pass, don't you? Because you can hold a driver behind.
You're dancing right on the edge all the time, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Who do you miss the most, Phil?
Well, obviously I miss Mike being around. He was a good friend, and obviously a lot of my friends who've retired now. Jim Redmond's good fun. Who else? Well, a lot of my sort of lesser friends who aren't about anymore, but in the classic scene, I've got lots of continental friends, and we have great fun. And Sean Emmett, who's just been released from Dubai, we have had good fun with him, especially drinking. Yeah.
Oh, you wouldn't do that, would you?
I had to teach him how to pour a Belgian beer.
Right. There's a technique.
Well, you have the beer open, of course, and you put the glass on it, turn it upside down, and as you lift it, all the froth goes up into the bottle. Mm-hmm. And you're left with a full glass of beer.
And no froth.
A little, but yeah, he went, oh, bloody hell. And he's a heavy drinker, or was.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. That's added to my... I mean, I'm a non-drinker, so it doesn't really bother me one way or the other. But certainly added to my storehouse of knowledge.
Well, let's go to the bar and I'll show you.
Phil, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. It's fabulous to have you here at this meeting. Are you having fun?
On the bike, I can't, the boots I've been loaned over here won't fit the gear shift, and I'm a danger to the other riders, I think, really. So I'm not gonna race, not on that 250 Yamaha. Lovely bike, but I haven't got my gear here. I've got borrowed leathers, borrowed boots, and gloves, okay. And it's not quite me, you know.
So are you superstitious like that?
Not superstitious, no.
You just need to be
careful. I could work with those. I could work them, okay, because they're slim, but
yes.
The boots I've got, like motocross
big
boots.
Big clunky ones.
Yes. And you can feel nothing.
No.
And with a bike, you know, on the limits, you've got to have a gentle, delicate touch.
And confidence.
Yeah, exactly.
If you haven't
yeah.
got the confidence,
yeah.
then you can't commit yourself.
I know. Well, I don't want to crash at my age, because I'll take longer to repair. And I've got lots to do this year.
This is true. This yeah. is true.
Feel well, I'm very happy, actually, to have arrived at 75 years old and having done what I've done, and have four great sons.
Absolutely.
One is he's the chief pilot for Cathay Pacific.
Right.
Well, I just missed him in Hong Kong. He just was leaving as I was arriving. And the second one, Graham, who is the Dunlop Combination Manager, looking after the Moto 2 and Moto 3 boys. It's great, goes around the world. Phil Jr., he's the marketing and advertising director for Piaggio in England. And the younger one, the younger, he's 40.
Who said he could do that?
And I've got, six, seven grandchildren, you see.
Wow, fabulous.
Oh, okay. You know, they don't smoke and they don't drink and they don't do drugs, and I'm very fortunate.
And they're going to keep you in a manner to which you've never been accustomed in your old age.
Well, I should hope, yeah.
Yeah. Phil, thank you so much for your time. Apart from spending the time with us, I've kept you from your lunch, and I apologise for that as well. It's been fabulous to talk to. When I found out that you were going to be here, that was my first...
I need a beer to...
My first priority was to make sure that I got some time to sit down and talk to you
okay.
and have a talk to you about those days, because it really is... It's been a great pleasure, and thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
I haven't got my wallet here.
Oh, you don't have to pay. It's all right.